This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents
Before They're Hanged, the second book in the First Law series by Joe Abercrombie. Read by Stephen Pacey. Part 1. We should forgive our enemies, but not before they are hanged. Heinrich Heine. Chapter 1. The Great Leveler. Damn mist. It gets in your eyes so you can't see no more than a few strides ahead. It gets in your ears so you can't hear nothing. And when you do, you can't tell where it's coming from. It gets up your nose so you can't smell naught but wet and damp. Damn mist. It's a curse on a scout. They'd crossed the White Flow a few days before, out of the north and into Angland, and the dogman had been nervy all the way. Scouting out strange land in the midst of a war that weren't really their business. All the lads were jumpy. Aside from Three Trees, none of them had ever been out of the north. Except for Grimm, maybe. He weren't saying where he'd been. They'd passed a few farms burnt out. A village all empty of people. Union buildings, big and square. They'd seen the tracks of horses and men, lots of tracks, but never the men themselves. Dogman knew Bethod weren't far away, though. His army spread out across the land, looking for towns to burn, food to steal, people to kill, all manner of mischief. He'd have scouts everywhere. If he caught Dogman or any of the rest, they'd be back to the mud, and not quickly. Bloody cross, and heads on spikes, and all the rest of it, Dogman didn't wonder. If the Union caught them, they'd be dead too, most likely. It was a war, after all, and folk don't think too clearly in a war. Dogman could hardly expect them to waste time telling a friendly Northman from an unfriendly one. Life was fraught with dangers, all right. It was enough to make anyone nervy. And he was a nervy sort at the best of times. So it was easy to see how the mist might have been salt in the cut, so to speak. All this creeping around in the murk had got him thirsty, so he picked his way through the greasy brush over to where he could hear the river chattering. He knelt down at the water's edge, slimy down there, with rot and dead leaves, but Dogman didn't reckon a little slime would make the difference. He was about as dirty as a man could be already. He scooped up water in his hands and drank. There was a breath of wind down there, out beyond the trees, pushing the mist in close one minute, dragging it out the next. That's when the Dogman saw him. He was lying on his front, legs in the river, top half up on the bank. They stared at each other for a while, both fully shocked and amazed. He'd got a long stick coming out of his back, a broken spear. That's when the Dogman realized he was dead. He spat the water out and crept over, checking careful all around to make sure no one was waiting to give him a blade in the back. The corpse was a man of about 24. Yellow hair, brown blood on his grey lips. He'd got a padded jacket on, bloated up with wet, the kind a man might wear under a coat of mail. A fighting man, then. A straggler, maybe. Lost his crew and been picked off. A Union man, no doubt, but he didn't look so different to Dogman or to anyone else now he was dead. One corpse looks much like another. The Great Leveler, Dogman whispered to himself, since he was in a thoughtful frame of mind. That's what the hillmen call him. Death, that is. He levels all differences. Named men and nobodies, south or north. He catches everyone in the end. And he treats each man the same. Seemed like this one had been dead no more than a couple of days. That meant whoever killed him might still be close, and that got the Dogman worried. The mist seemed full of sounds now. Might have been 100 carls waiting just out of sight. Might have been no more than the river slapping at its banks. Dogman left the corpse lying and slunk off into the trees, ducking from one trunk to another as they loomed up out of the grey. He nearly stumbled on another body, half buried in a heap of leaves, lying on his back with his arms spread out. He passed one on his knees, a couple of arrows in his side, face in the dirt, arse in the air. There's no dignity in death, and that's a fact. The dogman was starting to hurry along, too keen to get back to the others, tell them what he'd seen, too keen to get away from them corpses. He'd seen plenty, of course, more than his share, but he'd never quite got comfortable around them. It's an easy thing to make a man a carcass. He knew a thousand ways to do it. But once you've done it, there's no going back. One minute he's a man, all full up with hopes and thoughts and dreams, a man with friends and family and a place where he's from. Next minute, he's mud. Made the dog man think on all the scrapes he'd been in, all the battles and the fights he'd been a part of. Made him think he was lucky still to be breathing. Stupid lucky. Made him think his luck might not last. He was halfway running now, careless, blundering about in the mist like an untried boy, not taking his time, not sniffing the air, not listening out. A named man like him, a scout who'd been all over the north, should have known better, but you can't stay sharp all the time. He never saw it coming. Something knocked him in the side, hard, ditched him right on his face. He scrambled up, but someone kicked him down. Dogman fought, but whoever this bastard was, he was fearsome strong. Before he knew it, he was down on his back in the dirt, and he'd only himself to blame. Himself, and the corpses, and the mist. A hand grabbed him round his neck, started squeezing his windpipe shut. He croaked, fiddling at the hand, thinking his last moment was on him, thinking all his hopes were turned to mud. The great leveller, come for him at last. Then the fingers stopped squeezing.
"Dogman," said someone in his ear. "That you?"
The hand let go his throat, and he sucked in a breath, felt himself pulled up by his coat.
"Shit on it, dogman! I could have killed ya!"
He knew the voice now well enough. Black Dow, the bastard. Dogman was half annoyed at being throttled near to dying, half stupid happy at still being alive. He could hear Dow laughing at him. Hard laughter, like a crow calling.
"You all right?" "I've had warmer greetings," croaked Dogman, still doing his best to get the air in. "Count yourself lucky. I could have given you a colder one, much colder. I took you for one of Bethod's scouts. Thought you was out over yonder up the valley."
"As you can see," he whispered. "No. Where's the others at?"
"Up on a hill, above this fucking mist. Taking a look around."
Dogman nodded back the way he'd come.
"There's corpses over there. Loads of them."
"Loads of them, is it?"
asked Dow, as though he didn't think Dogman knew what a load of corpses looked like.
"Ha! Aye, a good few anyway. Union dead, I reckon. Looks like there was a fight here."
Black Dow laughed again.
"A fight, you reckon?"
Dogman wasn't sure what he meant by that.
"Shit," he said.
They were standing up on the hill, the five of them. The mist had cleared up, but the dogman almost wished it hadn't. He saw what Dow had been saying now well enough. The whole valley was full of dead. They were dotted high up on the slopes, wedged between the rocks, stretched out in the gorse. They were scattered out across the grass in the valley bottom like nails spilled from a sack, twisted and broken on the brown dirt road. They were heaped up beside the river, heaped on the banks in a pile, arms and legs and broken gear sticking up from the last shreds of mist. They were everywhere, stuck with arrows, stabbed with swords, hacked with axes. Crows called as they hopped from one meal to the next. It was a good day for the crows. It had been a while since Dogman saw a proper battlefield, and it brought back some sour memories, horrible sour.
"Shit," he said again.
couldn't think of aught else to say.
Reckon the Union were marching up this road.
Three Trees was frowning hard.
Reckon they were hurrying, trying to catch Bethord unawares. Seems they weren't scouting too careful,
rumbled Tull Duru.
Seems like it was Bethord caught them out.
Maybe it was misty, said Dogman. Like today.
Three Trees shrugged.
Maybe. It's the time of year for it. Either way, they were on the road, in column, tired from a long day's tramp. Bethord came on them from here, and from up there on the ridge. Arrows first to break them up, then the carles, coming down from the tall ground, screaming and ready to go. The Union broke quick, I reckon.
Real quick, said Dow.
And then it was a slaughter. Spread out on the road, trapped against the water. Nowhere much to run to. Men trying to pull their armour off, men trying to swim the river with their armour on, packing in and climbing one on top of the other, with arrows falling down all round. Some of them might have got as far as those woods down there, but knowing Bethord, he'd have had a few horsemen tucked away ready to lick the plate.
Shit, said Dogman, feeling more than a bit sick. He'd been on the wrong end of a rout himself, and the memory weren't at all a happy one.
Neat as good stitching, said Three Trees. You gotta give Bethel his due, the bastard. He knows his work, none better.
This is the end of it then, Chief? Asked Dogman. Bethord won already.
Three Trees shook his head nice and slow.
There's a lot of southerners out there, an awful lot. Most of them live across the sea. They say there's more of them down there than you can count. More men than there are trees in the north. Might take them a while to get here, but they'll be coming. This is just the beginning.
The Dogman looked out at the wet valley, at all them dead men huddled and sprawled and twisted across the ground, no more than food for crows.
Not much of a beginning for them.
Dow curled his tongue and spat as noisy as he could.
Pinned up and slaughtered like a bunch of sheep. You want to die like that, Three Trees, eh? You want to side with the likes of these? Fucking Union. They don't know anything about war.
Three Trees nodded.
Then I reckon we'll have to teach them.
There was a great press round the gate. There were women, gaunt and hungry-looking. There were children, ragged and dirty. There were men, old and young, stooped under heavy packs or clutching gear. Some had mules or carts they were pushing, loaded up with all kinds of useless-looking stuff. Wooden chairs, tin pots, tools for farming. A lot had nothing at all besides misery. The Dogman reckoned there was plenty of that to go round. They were choking up the road with their bodies and their rubbish. They were choking up the air with their pleading and their threatening. Dogman could smell the fear, thick as soup in his nose, all running from Bethord. They were shouldering each other pretty good, some pushing in, some pushed out, here and there one falling in the mud, all desperate for that gate like it was their mother's tit. But as a crowd, they were going nowhere. Dogman could see spear tips glinting over the heads of the press, could hear hard voices shouting. There were soldiers up ahead, keeping everyone out of the city. Dogman leaned over to Three Trees.
"Looks like they don't want their own kind," he whispered. "You reckon they'll want us, Chief?" "They need us, and that's a fact. We'll talk to them, and then we'll see. Or you got some better notion?"
"Going home and staying out of it?" muttered Dogman under his breath, but he followed Three Trees into the crowd anyway. The southerners all gawped as they stepped on through. There was a little girl among them, looked at Dogman as he passed with great staring eyes, clutching some old rag to her. Dogman tried a smile, but it had been a long time since he'd dealt with aught but hard men and hard metal, and it can't have come out too pleasing. The girl screamed and ran off, and she wasn't the only one scared. The crowd split open, wary and silent when they saw Dogman and Three Trees coming, even though they'd left their weapons back with the others. They made it through to the gate all right, only having to give the odd shove to one man or another just to start him moving.
Dogman saw the soldiers now, a dozen of them, stood in a line across the gate, each one just the same as the one next door. He'd rarely seen such heavy armour as they had on, great plates from head to toe, polished to a blinding shine, helmets over their faces, stock still like metal pillars. He wondered how you'd fight one, if you had to. He couldn't imagine an arrow doing much, or a sword even, unless it got lucky and found a joint.
You'd need a pickaxe for that or something.
What?
Hissed Three Trees.
Nothing.
It was plain they had some strange ideas about fighting down in the Union. If wars were won by the shinier side, they'd have had Bethod well licked, the Dogman reckoned. Shame they weren't. Their chief was sat in the midst of them, behind a little table with some scraps of paper on it, and he was the strangest of the lot. He'd got some jacket on, bright red. An odd sort of cloth for a leader to wear, Dogman thought. You'd have picked him out with an arrow easy enough. He was mighty young for the job and all. Scarcely had a beard on him yet, though he looked proud enough of himself all the same. There was a big man in a dirty coat arguing with him. Dogman strained to listen, trying to make sense of their Union words.
"I've five children out here," the farmer was saying, "and nothing to feed them with. What do you suggest I do?"
An old man got in first.
"I'm a personal friend of the Lord Governor. I demand you admit me to the—"
The lad didn't let either one finish.
"I don't give a damn who your friends are, and I don't care if you have 100 children. The city of Austenholm is full. Lord Marshal Burr has decreed that only 200 refugees be admitted each day, and we have already reached our limit for this morning. I suggest you come back tomorrow, early."
The two men stood there staring.
"Your limit?" growled the farmer. "But the Lord Governor, damn you!" screamed the lad, thumping at the table in a fit. "Only push me further! I'll let you in, all right. I'll have you dragged in and hung as traitors!"
That was enough for those two. They backed off quick. Dogman was starting to think he should do the same, but Three Trees was already making for the table. The boys scowled up at them as though they stank worse than a pair of fresh turds. Dogman wouldn't have been so bothered, except he'd washed specially for the occasion. Hadn't been this clean in months.
"What the hell do you want? We've no need of spies or beggars."
"Good," said Three Trees, clear and patient. "We're neither. My name is Rud Three Trees. This here is the Dogman. We're come to speak to whoever's in charge. We're come to offer our services to your king."
"Offer your services?" The lad started to smile, not a friendly smile at all. "Dogman, you say? What an interesting name. I can't imagine how he came by it." He had himself a little snigger at that piece of cleverness, and Dogman could hear chuckles from the others. A right set of arseholes, he reckoned, stitched up tight in their fancy clothes and their shiny armour. A right set of arseholes. But there was nothing to be gained by telling him so. It was a good thing they'd left Dow behind. He'd most likely have gutted this fool already and got them all killed. The lad leaned forward and spoke real slow, as if to children.
"No Northmen are allowed within the city, not without special permission."
Seemed that Bethod, crossing their borders, slaughtering their armies, making war across their lands, weren't special enough. Three Trees ploughed on, but the Dogman reckoned he was ploughing in stony ground all right.
"We're not asking much. Only food and a place to sleep. There's five of us, each one a named man, veterans all."
"His Majesty is more than well supplied with soldiers. We're a little short of mules, however. Perhaps you'd care to carry some supplies for us." Three Trees was known for his patience, but there was a limit to it, and Dogman reckoned they were awful close. This prick of a boy had no idea what he was stepping on. He weren't a man to be toyed with, Rud Three Trees. It was a famous name where they came from, a name to put fear in men, or courage, depending where they stood. There was a limit to his patience, all right, but they weren't quite at it yet, luckily for all concerned.
"Mules, eh?" growled Three Trees. "Mules can kick. Best make sure one don't kick your head off, boy."
And he turned around and stalked off down the road the way they came,
the scared folks shuffling out the way, then crowding back in behind, all shouting at once, pleading with the soldiers why they should be the ones to get let in, while the others were left out in the cold.
"That weren't quite the welcome we was hoping for," Dogman muttered.
Three Trees said nothing, just marched away in front, head down.
"What now, Chief?"
The old boy shot a grim look over his shoulder.
"You know me. You think I'm taking that fucking answer?"
Somehow, the Dogman reckoned not.
Chapter 2. Best Laid Plans. It was cold in the hall of the Lord Governor of Angland. The high walls were of plain cold render, the wide floor was of cold stone flags, the gaping fireplace held nothing but cold ashes. The only decoration was a great tapestry hanging at one end, the golden sun of the Union stitched into it, the crossed hammers of Angland in its centre. Lord Governor Mead was slumped in a hard chair before a huge bare table, staring at nothing, his right hand slack around the stem of a wine cup. His face was pale and hollow, his robes of state were crumpled and stained, his thin white hair was in disarray. Major West, born and raised in Angland, had often heard Mead spoken of as a strong leader, a great presence, a tireless champion of the province and its people. He looked a shell of a man now, crushed under the weight of his great chain of office, as empty and cold as his yawning fireplace. The temperature might have been icy, but the mood was cooler still. Lord Marshal Burr stood in the middle of the floor, feet placed wide apart, big hands clasped white-knuckled tight behind his back. Major West stood at his shoulder, stiff as a log, head lowered, wishing that he had not given up his coat. It was colder in here than outside, if anything, and the weather was bitter, even for autumn.
"Will you take wine, Lord Marshal?"
murmured Mead, not even looking up. His voice seemed weak and reedy thin in the great space. West fancied he could almost see the old man's breath smoking.
"No, Your Grace, I will not."
Burr was frowning. He had been frowning constantly, as far as West could tell, for the last month or two. The man seemed to have no other expressions. He had a frown for hope, a frown for satisfaction, a frown for surprise. This was a frown of the most intense anger. West shifted nervously from one numb foot to the other, trying to get the blood flowing, wishing he was anywhere but here.
"What about you, Major West?"
whispered the Lord Governor.
"Will you take wine?"
West opened his mouth to decline, but Burr got in first.
"What happened?"
he growled, the hard words grating off the cold walls, echoing in the chilly rafters.
"What happened?"
The Lord Governor shook himself, turned his sunken eyes slowly towards Burr, as though seeing him for the first time.
"I lost my sons."
He snatched up his cup with a trembling hand and drained it to the dregs. West saw Marshal Burr's hands clench tighter still behind his back.
"I am sorry for your loss, Your Grace, but I was referring to the broader situation. I'm talking of Blackwell."
Mead seemed to flinch at the mere mention of the place.
"There was a battle."
"There was a massacre," barked Burr. "What is your explanation? Did you not receive the king's orders to raise every soldier you could, to man your defences, to await reinforcements? Under no circumstances to risk battle with Bethod."
"The king's orders?"
The Lord Governor's lip curled.
"The closed council's orders, do you mean? I received them, I read them, I considered them."
"And then?"
"I tore them up."
West could hear the Lord Marshal breathing hard through his nose.
"You tore them up?"
"For 100 years, I and my family have governed Angland. When we came here, there was nothing."
Mead raised his chin proudly as he spoke, puffing out his chest.
"We tamed the wilderness. We cleared the forests and laid the roads and built the farms and the mines and the towns that have enriched the whole Union."
The old man's eyes had brightened considerably. He seemed taller, bolder, stronger.
"The people of this land look first to me for protection before they look across the sea. Was I to allow these Northmen, these barbarians, these animals, to raid across my lands with impunity? To undo the great work of my forefathers? To rob and burn and rape and kill as they pleased? To sit behind my walls while they put Angland to the sword? No, Marshal Burr, not I. I gathered every man, and I armed them, and I sent them to meet the savages in battle, and my three sons went at their head. What else should I have done?"
"Followed your fucking orders!"
screamed Burr at the very top of his voice. West started with shock, the thunderous echoes still ringing in his ears. Mead twitched, then gaped, then his lip began to quiver. Tears welled up in the old man's eyes, and his body sagged again.
"I lost my sons,"
he whispered, staring down at the cold floor.
"I lost my sons."
"I pity your sons and all those others whose lives were wasted, but I do not pity you. You alone brought this upon yourself."
Burr winced, then swallowed and rubbed at his stomach. He walked slowly to the window and looked out over the cold grey city.
"You have wasted all your strength, and now I must dilute my own to garrison your towns, your fortresses. Such survivors as there are from Blackwell, and such others as are armed and can fight, you will transfer to my command. We will need every man."
"And me?" murmured Mead. "I dare say those dogs on the closed council are howling for my blood."
"Let them howl. I need you here. Refugees are coming southwards, fleeing from Bethod, or from the fear of him. Have you looked out of your window lately? Austenhorn is full of them. They crowd around the walls, and they're thousands, and this is only the beginning. You will see to their well-being and their evacuation to Middleland. For 30 years your people have looked to you for protection. They have need of you still."
Burr turned back into the room.
"You will provide Major West with a list of those units still fit for action. As for the refugees, they are in need of food and clothing and shelter. Preparations for their evacuation should begin at once."
"At once?" whispered Mead. "At once, of course."
Burr flashed West a quick glance from under his thick eyebrows, took a deep breath, then strode for the door. West looked back as he left. The Lord Governor of Angland still sat hunched in his chair, in his empty, freezing hall, head in his hands.
"This is Angland," said West, gesturing at the great map. He turned to look at the assembly. Few of the officers were showing the slightest interest in what he had to say. Hardly a surprise, but it still rankled. General Croy was sitting on the right-hand side of the long table, stiff upright and motionless in his chair. He was tall, gaunt, hard, grey hair cropped close to his angular skull, black uniform simple and spotless. His enormous staff was similarly clipped, shaved, polished, as dour as a bevy of mourners. Opposite, on the left, lounged General Polder, round-faced, ruddy-skinned, possessed of a tremendous set of moustaches. His great collar, stiff with gold thread, came almost to his large pink ears. His retinue sat their chairs like saddles, crimson uniforms dripping with braid, top buttons carelessly undone, spatters of mud from the road worn like medals. On Croy's side of the room, war was all about cleanliness, self-denial, and strict obedience to the rules. On Polder's, it was a matter of flamboyance and carefully organized hair. Each group glared across the table at the other with haughty contempt, as though only they held the secrets of good soldiering, and the other crowd, try as they might, would never be more than a hindrance. Either were hindrance enough to West's mind,
but neither one was half the obstacle that the third lot presented, clustered around the far end of the table. Their leader was none other than the heir to the throne, Crown Prince Ladislaw himself. It was not so much a uniform that he was wearing as a kind of purple dressing gown with epaulettes. Bedwear with a military motif. The lace on his cuffs alone could have made a good-sized tablecloth, and his staff were little less remarkable in their finery. Some of the richest, most handsome, most elegant, most useless young men in the whole Union were sprawled in their chairs around the prince. If the measure of a man was the size of his hat, these were great men indeed. West turned back to the map, his throat uncomfortably dry. He knew what he had to say. He needed only to say it as clearly as possible and sit down. Never mind that some of the most senior men in the army were behind him, not to mention the heir to the throne. Men who West knew despised him, hated him for his high position and his low birth, for the fact that he had earned his place. "This is Angland," said West again in what he hoped was a voice of calm authority. "The River Cumna," and the end of his stick traced the twisting blue line of the river, "splits the province into two parts. The southern part is much the smaller, but contains the great majority of the population and almost all the significant towns, including the capital, Austenholm. The roads here are reasonably good, the country relatively open. As far as we know, the Northmen have yet to set foot across the river." West heard a loud yawning behind him, clearly audible even from the far end of the table. He felt a sudden pang of fury and spun round. Prince Ladislaw himself appeared, at least, to be listening attentively. The culprit was one of his staff, the young Lord Smund, a man of impeccable lineage and immense fortune, a little over 20, but with all the talents of a precocious 10-year-old. He was slouched in his chair, staring into space, mouth extravagantly gaping. It was the most West could do to stop himself leaping over and thrashing the man with his stick. "Am I boring you?" he hissed. Smund actually seemed surprised to be picked on. He stared left and right, as though West might have been talking to one of his neighbours. "What, me? No, no, Major West, not in the least. Boring, no. The River Cumna splits the province in two, and so forth. Thrilling stuff, thrilling. I do apologize, really. Late night last night, you see." West did not doubt it. A late night spent drinking and showing off with the rest of the prince's hangers-on, all so that he could waste everyone's time this morning. Croy's men might be pedantic and Polder's arrogant, but at least they were soldiers. The prince's staff had no skills whatever, as far as West could see, beyond annoying him, of course. At that, they were all expert. He was almost grinding his teeth with frustration as he turned back to the map. "The northern part of the province is a different matter," he growled. "An unwelcoming expanse of dense forests, trackless bogs, and broken hills sparsely populated. There are mines, logging camps, villages, as well as several penal colonies operated by the Inquisition, but they are widely scattered. There are only two roads even faintly suitable for large bodies of men or supplies, especially given that winter will soon be upon us." His stick traced the two dotted lines running north to south through the woods. "The western road goes close to the mountains, linking the mining communities. The eastern one follows the coast, more or less. They meet at the fortress of Dunbreck on the White Flow, the northern border of Angland. That fortress, as we all know, is already in the hands of the enemy." West turned away from the map and sat down, trying to breathe slow and steady, squash down his anger, and see off the headache which was already starting to pulse behind his eyes. "Thank you, Major West," said Burr as he got to his feet to address the assembly. The room rustled and stirred, only now coming awake. The Lord Marshal strode up and down before the map for a moment, collecting his thoughts. Then he tapped at it with his own stick, a spot well to the north of the Cumna. "The village of Blackwell," An unremarkable settlement, 10 miles or so from the coast road. Little more than a huddle of houses, now entirely deserted. It isn't even marked on the map. A place unworthy of anyone's attention. Except, of course, that it is the site of a recent massacre of our troops by the Northmen.
Damn fool Anglanders, someone muttered.
They should have waited for us, said Polder, with a self-satisfied smirk.
Indeed they should have, snapped Burr. But they were confident, and why not? Several thousand men well-equipped with cavalry. Many of them were professional soldiers, not in the same class as the king's own, perhaps, but trained and determined nonetheless. More than a match for these savages, one would have thought.
They put up a good fight, though, interrupted Prince Ladislaw. Eh, Marshal Burr?
Burr glared down the table.
A good fight is one you win, Your Highness. They were slaughtered. Only those with good horses and very good luck escaped. In addition to the regrettable waste of manpower, there is the loss of equipment and supplies. Considerable quantities of each, with which our enemy is now enriched. Most seriously, perhaps, the defeat has caused panic among the population. The roads our army will depend on are clogged with refugees, convinced that Bethod will come upon their farms, their villages, their homes at any moment. An utter disaster, of course. Perhaps the worst suffered by the Union in recent memory. But disasters are not without their lessons.
The Lord Marshal planted his big hands firmly on the table and leaned forwards. This Bethod is careful, clever, and ruthless. He is well supplied with horse, foot, and archers, and has sufficient organization to use them together. He has excellent scouts, and his forces are highly mobile, probably more so than ours, especially in difficult country, such as that we will face in the northern part of the province. He set a trap for the Anglanders, and they fell into it. We must not do the same. General Croy gave a snort of joyless laughter.
So, we should fear these barbarians, Lord Marshal? Would that be your advice?
What was it that Stolichus wrote, General Croy? Never fear your enemy, but always respect him. I suppose that would be my advice, if I gave any.
Burr frowned across the table.
But I don't give advice. I give orders.
Croy twitched with displeasure at the reprimand, but at least he shut up, for the time being. West knew that he wouldn't stay quiet for long. He never did.
We must be cautious, continued Burr, now addressing the room at large. But we still have the advantage. We have 12 regiments of the king's own, at least as many men in levies from the noblemen, and a few Anglanders who avoided the carnage at Blackwell. Judging from such reports as we have, we outnumber our enemy by 5 to 1 or more. We have the advantage in equipment and tactics in organization. The Northmen, it seems, are not ignorant of this. Despite their successes, they are remaining north of the Cumnor, content to forage and mount the odd raid. They do not seem keen to come across the river and risk an open battle with us.
One can hardly blame them, the dirty cowards,
chuckled Polder, to mutterings of agreement from his own staff.
Probably regretting they ever crossed the border now.
Perhaps, murmured Burr.
In any case, they are not coming to us, so we must cross the river and hunt them down. The main body of our army will therefore be split into 2 parts, the left wing under General Croy, the right under General Polder.
The 2 men eyed each other across the table with the deepest hostility.
We will push up the eastern road from our camps here at Austenholme, spread out beyond the River Cumnor, hoping to locate Bethod's army and bring him to a decisive battle.
With the greatest respect, interrupted General Croy in a tone that implied he had none, would it not be better to send 1/2 of the army up the western road?
The West has little to offer aside from iron, the one thing with which the Northmen are already well supplied.
The coast road offers richer pickings and is closer to their own lines of supply and retreat. Besides, I do not wish our forces to be too thinly spread. We are still guessing at Bethod's strength. If we can bring him to battle, I want to be able to concentrate our forces quickly and overwhelm him.
But, Lord Marshal!
Croy had the air of a man addressing a senile parent who still, alas, retains the management of their own affairs.
Surely the western road should not be left unguarded.
I was coming to that, growled Burr, turning back to the map. A third detachment, under the command of Crown Prince Ladislaw, will dig in behind the Cumnor and stand guard on the western road. It will be their job to make sure the Northmen do not slip around us and gain our rear. They will hold there south of the river while our main body splits in two and flushes out the enemy.
Of course, my Lord Marshal.
Croy sat back in his chair with a thunderous sigh, as though he had expected no better, but had to try anyway for everyone's sake, while the officers of his staff tutted and clucked their disapproval for the scheme.
"Well, I find it an excellent plan," announced Polder warmly.
He smirked across the table at Croy.
"I am entirely in favour, Lord Marshal. I am at your disposal in any way you should think fit. I shall have my men ready to march within 10 days."
His staff nodded and hummed their assent.
5 would be better," said Burr.
Polder's plump face twitched his annoyance, but he quickly mastered himself.
5 it is, Lord Marshal.
But now it was Croy's turn to look smug. Crown Prince Ladislaw, meanwhile, was squinting at the map, an expression of puzzlement slowly forming on his well-powdered face.
Lord Marshal Burr, he began slowly, my detachment is to proceed down the western road to the river, correct?
Indeed, Your Highness.
But we are not to pass beyond the river?
Indeed not, Your Highness.
Our role is to be then,
and he squinted up at Burr with a hurt expression,
a purely defensive one?
Indeed, purely defensive.
Ladislaw frowned.
That sounds a meagre task.
His absurd staff shifted in their seats, grumbled their discontent at an assignment so far beneath their talents.
A meagre task? Pardon me, Your Highness, but not so. Angland is a wide and tangled country. The Northmen may elude us, and if they do, it is on you that all our hopes will hang. It will be your task to prevent the enemy from crossing the river and threatening our lines of supply, or, worse yet, marching on Austenhorn itself.
Burr leaned forward, fixing the prince with his eye, and shook his fist with great authority.
You will be our rock, Your Highness, our pillar, our foundation. You will be the hinge on which the gate will hang, a gate which will swing shut on these invaders and drive them out of Angland.
West was impressed. The prince's assignment was indeed a meagre one, but the Lord Marshal could have made mucking out the latrine sound like noble work.
Excellent!
Exclaimed Ladislaw, the feather on his hat thrashing back and forth.
The hinge, of course, capital!
Unless there are any further questions, then, gentlemen, we have a great deal of work to do.
Burr looked round the half-circle of sulky faces. No one spoke.
Dismissed.
Croy's staff and Polder's exchanged frosty glances as they hurried to be first out of the room. The two great generals themselves jostled each other in the doorway, which was more than wide enough for both of them, neither wanting to turn his back on the other or to follow behind him. They turned, bristling, once they had pushed their way out into the corridor.
General Croy,
sneered Polder with a haughty toss of his head.
General Polder,
hissed Croy, tugging his impeccable uniform smooth. Then they stalked off in opposite directions. As the last of Prince Ladislaw's staff ambled out, holding forth to each other noisily about who had the most expensive armour, West got up to leave himself. He had 100 tasks to be getting on with, and there was nothing to be gained by waiting. Before he got to the door, though, Lord Marshal Burr began to speak.
"So, there's our army, eh, West? I swear I sometimes feel like a father with a set of squabbling sons and no wife to help me. Polder, Croy, and Ladislaw."
He shook his head.
"My three commanders. Every man of them seems to think the purpose of this whole business is his personal aggrandizement. There aren't three bigger heads in the whole Union. It's a wonder we can fit them all in one room."
He gave a sudden burp.
"Damn this indigestion."
West racked his brains for something positive. "General Polder seems obedient, at least, sir." Burr snorted.
"Seems, yes.
But I trust him even less than Croy, if that's possible. Croy at least is predictable. He can be depended on to frustrate and oppose me at every turn. Polder can't be depended on at all. He'll smirk and flatter and obey to the tiniest detail, until he sees some advantage to himself, and then he'll turn on me with double the ferocity, you'll see. To keep 'em both happy is impossible."
He squinted and swallowed, rubbing at his gut.
"But as long as we can keep them equally unhappy, we've a chance. The one thing to be thankful for is that they hate each other even more than they do me."
Burr's frown grew deeper.
"They were both ahead of me in the queue for my job. General Polder is an old friend of the Archlector, you know. Croy is Chief Justice Morovia's cousin. When the post of Lord Marshal became available, the closed council couldn't decide between them. In the end, they fixed on me as an unhappy compromise. An oath from the provinces, eh, West? That's what I am to them. An effective oath, to be sure, but an oath still. I dare say that if Polder or Croy died tomorrow, I'd be replaced the next day by the other. It's hard to imagine a more ludicrous situation for a Lord Marshal, until you add in the Crown Prince, that is."
West almost winced. How to turn that nightmare into an advantage?
"Prince Ladislaw is enthusiastic," he ventured. "Where would I be without your optimism?"
Burr gave a mirthless chuckle.
"Enthusiastic? He's living in a dream. Pandered to and coddled and utterly spoiled his whole life. That boy and the real world are entire strangers to one another."
"Must he have a separate command, sir?" The Lord Marshal rubbed at his eyes with his thick fingers.
"Unfortunately, he must. The closed council have been most specific on that point. They are concerned that the king is in poor health, and that his heir is seen as an utter fool and wastrel by the public. They hope we might win some great victory here, so they can heap the credit on the prince. Then they'll ship him back to Adua, glowing with the glamour of the battlefield, ready to become the kind of king the peasants love."
Burr paused for a moment and looked down at the floor.
"I've done all I can to keep Ladislaw out of trouble. I've put him where I think the Northmen aren't, and with any luck won't ever be. But war is anything but a predictable business. Ladislaw might actually be called upon to fight. That's why I need someone to look over his shoulder. Someone with experience in the field. Someone as tenacious and hard-working as his joke of a staff as soft and lazy. Someone who might stop the prince blundering into trouble."
He looked up from under his heavy brows. West felt a horrible sinking sensation in his guts.
"Me?" "I'm afraid so. There's no one I'd rather keep, but the prince has asked for you personally."
"For me, sir? But I'm not courtier. I'm not even a nobleman."
Burr snorted.
"Aside from me, Ladislaw is probably the one man in this army who doesn't care whose son you are. He's the heir to the throne. Nobleman or beggar, we're all equally far below him."
"But why me?"
"Because you're a fighter. Fast through the breach at Ulriach and all that. You've seen action and plenty of it. You've a fighter's reputation, West, and the prince wants one himself. That's why.
Burr fished a letter from his jacket and handed it across.
Maybe this will help to sweeten the medicine.
West broke the seal, unfolded the thick paper, scanned the few lines of neat writing. When he had finished, he read it again, just to be sure. He looked up.
It's a promotion.
I know what it is. I arranged it. Maybe they'll take you a little more seriously with an extra star on your jacket. Maybe they won't. Either way, you deserve it.
Thank you, sir, said West numbly.
What, for the worst job in the army?
Burr laughed and gave him a fatherly clap on the shoulder.
You'll be missed, and that's a fact. I'm riding out to inspect the 1st Regiment. A commander should show his face, I've always thought. Care to join me, Colonel?
Snow was falling by the time they rode out through the city gates, white specks blowing on the wind, melting as soon as they touched the road, the trees, the coat of West's horse, the armour of the guards that followed them.
"Snow," Burr grumbled over his shoulder. "Snow already. Isn't that a little early in the year?"
"Very early, sir. But it's cold enough."
West took one hand from his reins to pull his coat tighter round his neck.
"Colder than usual for the end of autumn. It'll be a damn sight colder up north of the Cumnor, I'll be bound."
"Yes, sir, and it won't be getting any warmer now."
"Could be a harsh winter, eh, Colonel?"
"Very likely, sir."
Colonel? Colonel West? The words still seemed strange together, even in his own mind. No one could ever have dreamed a commoner's son would go so far, himself least of all.
"A long, harsh winter," Burr was musing. "We need to catch Bethord quickly. Catch him and put a quick end to him before we all freeze."
He frowned at the trees as they slipped by, frowned up at the flecks of snow eddying around them, frowned over at West.
"Bad roads, bad ground, bad weather. Not the best situation, eh, Colonel?"
"No, sir,"
said West glumly. But it was his own situation that was worrying him.
"Come now, it could be worse. You'll be dug in south of the river, nice and warm. Probably won't see a hair of a Northman all winter. And I hear the prince and his staff eat pretty well. A damn stretch better than blundering around in the snow with Polder and Croy for company."
"Of course, sir."
But West was less than sure. Burr glanced over his shoulder at the guards, trotting along at a respectful distance.
"You know, when I was a young man, before I was given the dubious honour of commanding the king's army, I used to love to ride. I'd ride for miles at the gallop. Made me feel alive. Seems like there's no time for it these days. Briefings and documents and sitting at tables, that's all I do. Sometimes you just want to ride, eh, West?"
"Of course, sir, but now would—"
"Yah!"
The Lord Marshal dug his spurs in with a will, and his horse bolted down the track, mud flicking up from its hooves. West gaped after him for a moment.
"Damn it," he whispered.
The stubborn old fool would most likely get thrown and break his thick neck. Then where would they be? Prince Ladislaw would have to take command. West shivered at the prospect and kicked his own horse into a gallop. What choice did he have? The trees flashed past on either side, the road flowed by underneath him. His ears filled with the clattering of hooves, the rattling of harness. The wind rushed in his mouth, stung his eyes. The snowflakes came at him straight on. West snatched a look over his shoulder. The guards were tangled up with each other, horses jostling, lagging far back down the road. It was the best he could do to keep up and stay in his saddle at the same time. The last time he'd ridden so hard had been years ago, pounding across a dry plain with a wedge of Gurkish cavalry just behind him. He'd hardly been any more scared then. His hands were gripping the reins painfully tight. His heart was hammering with fear and excitement. He realized that he was smiling. Burr had been right. It did make him feel alive.
The Lord Marshal had slowed, and West reined his own horse in as he drew level. He was laughing now, and he could hear Bird chuckling beside him. He hadn't laughed like that in months. Years, maybe. He couldn't remember the last time. Then he noticed something out of the corner of his eye. He felt a sickening jolt, a crushing pain in his chest. His head snapped forward, the reins were ripped from his hands, everything turned upside down. His horse was gone. He was rolling on the ground, over and over. He tried to get up, and the world lurched. Trees and white sky, a horse's kicking legs, dirt flying. He stumbled and pitched into the road, took a mouthful of mud. Someone helped him up, pulling roughly at his coat, dragging him into the woods.
No!
He gasped, hardly able to breathe for the pain in his chest. There was no reason to go that way. A black line between the trees. He staggered forward, bent double, tripping over the tails of his coat, crashing through the undergrowth. A rope across the road, pulled tight as they passed. Someone was half dragging him, half carrying him. His head was spinning, all sense of direction lost. A trap. West fumbled for his sword. It took him a moment to realize that his scabbard was empty. The Northmen. West felt a stab of terror in his gut. The Northmen had him, and Burr, too. Assassins sent by Bethod to kill them. There was a rushing sound somewhere out beyond the trees. West struggled to make sense of it. The guards following down the road. If he could only give them a signal somehow.
Over here!
He croaked pitifully hoarse before a dirty hand clamped itself over his mouth, dragged him down into the wet undergrowth. He struggled as best he could, but there was no strength in him. He could see the guards flashing by through the trees, no more than a dozen strides away, but he was powerless. He bit the hand as hard as he could, but it only gripped tighter, squeezing his jaw, crushing his lips. He could taste blood, his own blood, maybe, or blood from the hand. The sound of the guards faded into the woods and was gone, and fear pressed in behind it. The hand let go, gave him a parting shove, and he tumbled onto his back. A face swam into view above him, a hard, gaunt, brutish face. Black hair hacked short, teeth bared in an animal scowl, cold, flat eyes brimful of fury. The face turned and spat on the ground. There was no ear on the other side of it, just a flap of pink scar and a hole. Never in his life had West seen such an evil-looking man. The whole set of him was violence itself. He looked strong enough to tear West in half, and more than willing to do it. There was blood running from a wound in his hand, the wound that West's teeth had made. It dripped from his fingertips onto the forest floor. In his other fist, he held a length of smooth wood. West's eyes followed it, horrified. There was a heavy, curved blade at the end, polished bright. An axe. So, this was a Northman. Not the kind who rolled drunk in the gutters of Adua. Not the kind who had come to his father's farm to beg for work. The other kind. The kind his mother had scared him with stories of when he was a child. A man whose work and whose pastime and whose purpose was to kill. West looked from that hard blade to those hard eyes and back, numb with horror. He was finished. He would die here in the cold forest, down in the dirt like a dog. West dragged himself up by one hand, seized by a sudden impulse to run. He looked over his shoulder, but there was no escape that way. A man was moving through the trees towards them. A big man, with a thick beard and a sword over his shoulder, carrying a child in his arms. West blinked, trying to get some sense of scale. It was the biggest man he had ever seen, and the child was Lord Marshal Burr. The giant tossed his burden down on the ground like a bundle of sticks. Burr stared up at him and burped. West ground his teeth. Riding off like that, the old fool. What had he been thinking? He'd killed them both with his fucking, sometimes you just want to ride. Makes you feel alive? Neither one of them would live out the hour. He had to fight. Now might be his last chance. Even if he had nothing to fight with, better to die that way than on his knees in the mud. He tried to dig the anger out. There was no end to it when he didn't want it. Now there was nothing, just a desperate helplessness that weighed down every limb. Some hero, some fighter. It was the most he could do to keep from pissing himself. He could hit a woman, all right. He could throttle his sister half to death. The memory of it still made him choke with shame and revulsion, even with his own death staring him in the face.